This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
It's good to be here and to see all of you. And I realize that I recognize only about half of you from when I was a pastor here right after World War I. And I look pretty good for 120 years old, don't I? Well, thanks for your prayers for our ministry and your financial support and your encouragement to us with Teaching Truth International. We appreciate that greatly. A little bit of family news. Some of you may know that Scott and his wife Heather had a new baby girl just 2.5 weeks ago. And so we just got to meet her coming through St. Louis on her way here. Her name is Ella Grace, and she is doing very well. Ben and Emily's little girl Zoe is now almost 2.5 and doing what 2.5-year-olds do, running around like a little wild woman and talking and reading. Her favorite topic to read is quantum physics, and they are having a great time. In fact, right at this moment, Ben and Jamin, one of our guys, are in between Amsterdam and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, flying to our training center in Mbeya, Tanzania. So you might remember to be praying for them. Well, Pastor Phil asked me to speak on missions and my passion for it, which I'm happy to do. And we'll warm up by looking at Paul and his passions for missions out of Romans 15. I believe you have an outline on the seat in front of you or next to you. You can see we'll be in Romans 15 from the middle of verse 19 through verse 24. Here's where we're going in this message. We'll first summarize that paragraph. Then we'll talk about the global missions picture. And thirdly, we'll talk about some of the government opposition to Christianity around the world. And then finally, some principles of application for each of us as Christians who are here in America. So let's begin by looking back at Paul, or looking at Paul as he looks back on where he's been in 19b. And then in 20 and 21, he's going to talk about his mission strategy. And then when he moves on into verses 22 and 24, he talks about where he wants to go, starting with 19b. Paul says, from Jerusalem all the way around to Illyricum, I have fully proclaimed the gospel of Christ. Paul's past ministry, past at the time that he wrote this, about the year 55, 56, had all been in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, from Jerusalem in the far southeast corner of that half, all the way up to Illyricum in the northwest corner of that eastern half of the Roman Empire. And his initial ministry in Jerusalem was recorded by his friend Luke, who wrote the book of Acts in addition to his gospel. Luke says this in Acts 9, 28 and 29 about Paul being in Jerusalem. Saul, as he was then called, Saul stayed with them, the Christians in Jerusalem, and moved about freely in Jerusalem, speaking boldly in the name of the Lord. He talked and debated with the Hellenistic Jews, but they tried to kill him. A preview of coming attractions for Paul, because we know he faced that kind of dilemma often in his ministry. Now, the book of Acts does not record Paul ever being in Illyricum, but the wording in our verse in Romans 15, 19 can mean and probably does mean that Paul made it to the border of Illyricum. It's not saying he went into that region. Now, we wonder, where is that today? That is what we today would call Albania, and those countries that broke up from Yugoslavia, Serbia, Herzegovina, Bosnia, Croatia, all of those areas are to the northeast, a northeast coast of the Adriatic Sea. When Paul says, I have fully proclaimed the gospel of Christ, he's not saying that he had saturated every square inch of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, but to have fulfilled his assignment in that part of the world. And we know what Paul typically did from looking at Acts. He would go into one of the major cities of a region, plant a church by preaching the gospel, teaching some of the basics of the word, and then he would expect his converts and students to spread the gospel out from that area. And we see a picture of that when we think about what Paul did in the city of Ephesus and how that spread from there, Acts 19:10. This went on, this is Paul's teaching, went on in Ephesus for 2 years, so that all the Jews and Greeks who lived in the province of Asia, a province in the Roman Empire is like a state for us, the province of Asia heard the word of the Lord. So Paul's preaching and teaching in Ephesus spread out through the entire province, by his students and those who learn from him. Now, keep in mind, the province of Asia doesn't mean Asia like we think of today, the big continent. It is a region in west and southwest Turkey, to use our regional description today. Now, it's spread out from there, and we see one of the results in Colossians 1:7. Paul says, "You, the Colossian believers, learned the gospel and Bible teaching from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant, who is a faithful minister of Christ on our behalf." The city of Colossae is about 100 miles east of Ephesus up the Kyster River. Paul had been teaching in Ephesus, which is near the coast and near the mouth of the Kyster River. Epaphras had obviously come to the city of Ephesus, bumped into Paul somehow, sat in on some of his Bible studies, learned enough of the word that he could go back and plant the church in Colossae, and almost certainly the church in Laodicea and Hierapolis, two smaller cities not far from Colossae. So that's the way Paul typically operated. Well, after summarizing Paul's past ministry, saying, "I've done my job in the eastern half of the empire," he now states his mission strategy in 20 and 21. He says, "It has always been my ambition to preach the gospel where Christ was not known, so that I would not be building on someone else's foundation. Rather, as it is written," and now he quotes Isaiah 52:15, "those who were not told about him," the future coming Messiah, future as of the time of Isaiah, about 7 centuries before Christ, "those who were not told about him will see, and those who have not heard will understand." Paul knew that his role was planting new churches in new places. He didn't want to build on somebody else's church plant. Now, he doesn't think there's anything wrong with that. He just says, that's not my job. That's not what God has called me to do. As he writes in 1 Corinthians 3:6, "I planted the seed." In other words, I came to Corinth and brought the gospel there and planted the Corinthian church. "Apollos watered it. He came in after me and taught you Corinthian Christians after I was gone." But of course, God gave the growth. God does all the work ultimately, and he gets the glory. So, raises a question for us. Why is Paul writing the church in Rome? He didn't plant the church in Rome. He's not been to Rome at the time of writing this. Isn't this sort of building on someone else's church plant? It kind of seems like that. Well, he'll explain in our coming verses. He wants to visit them and gain their help in his new mission field when he goes to Spain. And he lays out those future plans in the next verses, 22 through 24. He says, "This is why I have often been hindered from coming to you in Rome. But now that there is no more place for me to work in these regions back east, and since I've been longing for many years to see you in Rome, I plan to do so when I go to Spain. I hope to visit you while passing through and to have you assist me on my journey there after I've enjoyed your company for a while." Paul sort of apologizes to the Christians in Rome for not having come there. He says, I wanted to, but I wasn't able to because my work back east wasn't done. I needed to accomplish that mission, finish the job there before I could come. But now it is finished, and so I can come and see you on my way to Spain. That raises another question for us. Why Spain? After all, if Paul says, I want to go to new mission fields, there are a lot more new mission fields closer than Spain. Why did he pick that? Maybe that's the point. Spain was the farthest remote place in the ancient world. It's the very western edge of southwestern Europe. The very edge of the known world at the time. In fact, in the ancient world into the medieval time, people thought if you sailed out across that big ocean, you eventually just dropped off the edge. They didn't know there was a whole other world, the new world, the Americas out there. They thought you just disappeared off the edge. And I've even seen old maps that where is the Atlantic, what we call the Atlantic today, it was written, "There be monsters here." Because apparently some ancient sailors had gone out there, seen some big creepy sea creature, reported the news, and then some map maker said, "Hey, don't go out here, there be monsters here." Well, maybe that's the whole point, that Paul wants to go to Spain, the farthest edge of the world. But Paul faces a couple of challenges. First, there's a logistical challenge. He needed a base of operations or a headquarters closer to that very distant destination than his current base of operations in Antioch, way back east in Syria. That's the eastern end of the Roman Empire, east of the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. Spain is the very opposite end of the Mediterranean Sea and the opposite end of the Roman Empire. So Paul says, I got to have a place somewhere closer to set up my operation. Well, midway between Antioch in the east and Spain in the west sat the city of Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire, the hub of all transportation and communication in the whole empire. It was the best place to launch a new mission to way off Spain in the west. But Paul also has a personal challenge in this. He'd never been to Rome. The Christians there had not met him. They knew of him, of course, but they didn't know him personally. And they didn't know the details of his gospel presentation and his theology. So Paul wrote this letter to the Christians in Rome to ask for their help and to systematically explain his theology. And in the process, he tells the Romans, I'm going to visit you. And we know that Paul, in fact, wrote the letter as a systematic presentation of what he believes. You've studied Romans. The first 11 chapters are all this very organized, systematic theology for 11 chapters. Then in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, it's the hinge where he transitions to the application. In other words, like Paul often does in his letters, he says, here's what you as Christians need to know. Now, here's what you need to do on the basis of what you know. And he does that from chapter 12 through about chapter 15. Then chapter 16 is all those goodbyes to a whole lot of people. Well, we don't know if Paul got to Spain. It's one of the interesting historical questions of early Christianity. The book of Acts does not record him ever getting there, but he might have. It's possible. Notice the end of the book of Acts, 28, verses 30 and 31. Paul has gotten to Rome because he was arrested back in Jerusalem, sent to Caesarea. He appealed to Caesar, and he was said, okay, you can appeal to Caesar. You're a Roman citizen. You have that right. You remember the big ship journey, the storm that came and blew him off course, blew him onto the island of Malta, and Paul is helping fix the fire, and he gets bit on the hand. Well, he eventually makes it up to Rome. And Luke says at the last two verses of Acts, Paul is in his own rented apartment there in Rome, and he's allowed to have visitors come, and he talks with them about the gospel. In other words, Paul does not die at the end of the book of Acts. And we would really call that house arrest. He's not in prison yet. He's in his own rented apartment. So we would use our phrase, house arrest. However, Paul also tells us in the first chapter of Philippians, which he wrote during that time, that he was chained to a Roman soldier. So it's a pretty tight house arrest. Nevertheless, he's incarcerated there in Rome. He's not dead. Most New Testament scholars believe Paul was released and took a fourth missionary journey, which explains why the book of Titus, where Paul is with Titus on the island of Crete, which also does not come about as any lengthy visit in Acts. And it is believed that he might have also made it to Spain during that fourth missionary journey. In fact, today there are Christian communities in Spain that have the story that Paul did come there, and he is the one that brought the gospel to their cities. Those early church traditions are shaky history. We don't know how much are solid and how much are just legendary, but there are a couple of pieces of more solid historical information that might suggest Paul got there. Two church fathers, Jerome and Chrysostom, in the late 4th and early 5th century, they both write that Paul did make it to Spain. However, we also need to ask, where did they get their information? Had the information already been legendary and they're just repeating the legends? Or did they have solid historical verification that Paul made it? Well, we don't know. So on your list of 25,000 questions to ask when you get to heaven, make sure you have on your questions for Paul list, did you get to Spain? And if you did, what was it like? Tell us about that. I hope you're making a list. Well, that's a brief look at Paul's mission strategy from Romans 15. What is the global mission situation today? I'm going to talk first about some positive and then some negative. On the positive side, the gospel is spreading greatly. Some illustrations. The greatest church growth since Pentecost has been in China in the last two generations. When Mao Zedong and his communist thugs took over that huge country in 1949, there were only about 1 million Christians. Today, the estimates are about 130 million Christians. In 1900, Korea was thought to be utterly unreachable with the gospel because the people there were so hostile to it and even in some cases so violent toward missionaries who came. Today, it is half Christian. Sub-Sahara Africa, the part of Africa that is south of the Sahara Desert, about 60% of the geography of Africa, but most of the population, it is largely Christianized. So there is a positive side to the gospel spreading. On the negative side, there are about 2 million evangelical churches in the world today, but 85% of them don't have a pastor, or they have someone functioning in that role who's not been fully trained for the job. Another way to state that dilemma is that here in the U.S., there is one trained Christian worker, like a pastor, for every 235 Christians, one for 235. Outside the U.S., that ratio is one for every 450,000. Well, no wonder some people refer to that situation as a global theological famine. Indeed, it is. And the result is that due to a lack of trained pastors and teachers, global Christians are invaded daily by cults and witchcraft and heresies and false religions and every assorted weirdness you can imagine. It is the spiritual Wild West in most of the places we go. In some Chinese provinces, the Chinese cult known as Eastern Lightning, their most dangerous cult, has reportedly taken over a third of the house churches. And many global Christians never completely abandon their pagan past or their animistic past. They just incorporate Jesus into their old ways. I got a list of 27 gods, and I hear this Jesus is pretty good. I'm going to put him on the list too, not realizing that they got to get rid of the others if they're really going to believe in Jesus. In sub-Sahara Africa, millions go to church every Sunday, quite faithfully. But during the week, they'll go to a witch doctor to get a potion if they have a sick child, or to cast a curse on their neighbor or co-worker who they think gave them the evil eye. Well, all of that is due to a lack of biblical theological teaching because they don't have anybody trained to give that to them. So the long-term result of the last two centuries of gospel expansion is not all good. Now, it's not all bad, but it's not all good. And much of the recent spread in many parts of the world is according to the prosperity gospel, which is not a version of Christianity from within the Pentecostal wing of the church. That's what a lot of Christians think it is. It is not. The prosperity gospel is a descendant of a 19th century cultic movement known as New Thought. And the prosperity gospel can be historically traced all the way back to ancient paganism. The prosperity gospel is not Christian. It is a parasite on Christianity. So the need around the world is still enormous. The global church has literally hundreds of millions of people who know almost nothing of the scriptures. And God's people are vulnerable. They are theologically defenseless in the face of the heresies and the cults and the false religions. So after Christians leave, after the missionaries leave, somebody else knocks on the door. Turns out he's a Jehovah's Witness or a local cult, or it's back to Islam. They don't have an argument against it. They don't know because they don't have someone to teach them. And when an unreached people group finally hears the gospel and receives it, but does not get biblical theological training and someone to continue teaching them, like a trained pastor, it takes only one or two generations for that group to revert back to being unreached all over again. In fact, where our big work is done in 10 or 11 countries in Southeast Africa. We're working exactly where the great missionary David Livingstone worked 150 years ago. Somewhere between his time and today, or very recently, Bible teaching was stopped. I don't know when, but it did not continue to this day, and so the work has to be done all over again. And we see an intense desire to learn God's word and sound doctrine that I think has rarely been seen in America. I think probably not since the Great Awakening of Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield in the 1730s and 1740s. An illustration of that is from the Maasai people. You may know of the Maasai warriors, a very famous tribe in East Africa. The Maasai tribe lives up in northern Tanzania and southern Kenya, the country right to the north. About 3 years ago, one of my times when I was teaching in Tanzania, there was a Maasai pastor and his wife who traveled all the way across the country of Tanzania to come to our conference. This gentleman had suffered from polio when he was younger, so he had a bad leg. And a few weeks before they came, he was hit by a car, which damaged his other leg. His wife had severe malaria, and yet they spent 3 days in that condition traveling to come and hear Bible teaching, some of it by walking across the bush. That's passion to hear God's word. And yet here in America, you know, if it snows, depending on the part of the country, if it snows 2 inches, we can't come today. Now, if you get 2 inches in Minnesota, they don't even call that flurries. That's nothing yet. But anything prevents us from coming hearing the word today for so many Christians in America. And I've got other stories like that of unimaginable suffering and sacrifice and risk that people make to come and hear God's word. Well, what is the reason for this imbalance of so many people having come to Christ but not knowing enough to resist the cults? Well, there are probably a lot of answers for that, but one of them, I think, was an imbalance in what's called the modern missions movement, which was the time when missions began to flourish a little over 200 years ago. Many, many great heroic missionaries came out of the British Isles and North America, all over remote parts of the world at that time. And they did a fantastic job of obeying what I'll summarize as the first half of the Great Commission from Matthew 28, 19, and 20, essentially getting the gospel to lost people. They did a wonderful job doing that. But they largely neglected the second half of the Great Commission, that part you remember where Jesus said, teaching them to obey all that I have commanded you, teaching them, and all that I have commanded you is, by extension in our day, the whole Word of God. That was often not done. The missions pattern in too many parts of the world over the last 200 years has been to go into a village, give the gospel, lead a few people to Christ, start a little church, and then go to the next village, leaving those brand new baby Christians, again, biblically and theologically illiterate, bait for the spiritual enemy to come in and scarf up. So we see very positive things around the world and some very negative things as well. Well, our verse with Teaching Truth International, our functional verse is 2 Timothy 2:2, where Paul tells Timothy, his protege, his understudy, he says, "What you, Timothy, have learned from me, Paul, you teach to other faithful men who will teach yet others and others and others," implying keep it going, spiritual generation after generation. So our ministry is not primarily aimed at reaching the unreached, although there are some cases where that has happened. But we train guys who do go to the unreached. Our training center in Mbeya, Tanzania, is our main ministry on the continent of Africa. And our partner there is a man named Pastor David Akandowe, a wonderful brother. And at our training center, over the years, we've had, I'm not sure if it'd be 1,000 pastors come yet, but it'd be multiple hundreds have come in for our training. And Pastor David says that about 36 of our students have gone back to their little villages and their little bush churches and set up secondary training centers where they bring in pastors from even more remote in the bush to learn the teaching that those guys got from us when we teach in Mbeya. Another story similar to that is from the Miskito community, a Native American tribe in Nicaragua. A few years ago, one of the brothers in my class in Puerto Cabeza was telling me how the gospel first came to the Caribbean coast, called the Miskito Coast there. Miskito is it's not our bug. Yeah, that's what most people think when I mention this. It's a different spelling. They call themselves the Miskito Indians. Well, he was telling me the gospel first came to their area along the coast about 200 years ago from Moravian missionaries out of Germany. However, the gospel did not spread into the interior country. It stayed along the coast. It did not go into the interior country and reach the Mayana people, a very remote people in the bush of north central Nicaragua. And he told me the story of how eventually the gospel did go in there. He said people walked for 3 days, including going across rivers up to their chest that had the big crocs in them, and there's the big boa constrictors in the trees, and there's jaguars, the big cats in the bush. And so it's very dangerous to take the gospel into the Mayana people, this very remote tribal people. And this brother still comes. I said, my goodness, that's a fantastic story. Where did you hear that? And he said, well, that was me. It had just been a few years before, probably 20 years ago from our time. He still comes to class when we teach there in Puerto Cabeza, takes notes, and he still goes back into those little bush churches that he helped plant perhaps 20 years ago, and he teaches back in that very remote part of Central America. At this point, I'll insert a little bit about our training center. I've mentioned that a couple of times. I should probably explain a little more about that. When we first started teaching in the city of Mbeya, Tanzania, it was just in Pastor David's church, but it grew so much that we couldn't get everybody in there. So we are building a training center that is going to accommodate 250 to 300 pastors at the same time. We've first of all put up the security wall around the outside to keep, you know, thieves and bad characters out. And we've completed the training hall, which can hold, like I said, close to 300 pastors, and the bathroom facilities, the kitchen. And so all of that first phase, phase one, is completed, and it's already paid for. God has provided the payment for that. And we're now about ready to kick off phase two. And that'll cost about $75,000 more to finish phase two. And to finish all four phases, it'll probably take about $500,000. The whole project is about $1.4 million. And God has provided greatly on that. In fact, Ben, for those who don't know, Ben is my son, who's now the president of TTI. I've slid into the old man position of just being senior teacher, which basically means I just get to study and teach, and Ben has all the administrative nonsense that I don't like to do. And he thinks he's been promoted. I think I've been promoted. So, well, Ben and our new vice president, filling in after Ben being vice president, Jamin, a wonderful brother from South Dakota, right now they're on their way to Tanzania to inspect the property and talk with the construction team. In fact, at this moment, they would be between Amsterdam and Dar es Salaam on that long, long flight across Europe and Africa. Anyway, God has provided that. We're hoping that that'll be a ministry for some generations ahead. Well, as the gospel has spread, governments are very adamant. Some governments are very adamant to prevent it. And I'll list several of them here just briefly. China is the place I was most often. I was in China 36 different times. I cannot go back anymore. Because President Xi Jinping, who sees himself as the new Mao Zedong and is becoming just as brutal as that former dictator, he is putting pressure on Christians there, including Christians who come in, and my students and friends, the last several times I was over there, were saying, Rick, it's not safe for you to come anymore. You need to stop coming. And finally, the last time, they just said, Rick, don't come. Do not come. It is too dangerous, so I can't go back anymore. In some cases, some churches have been destroyed, some pastors have been detained, and a few disappeared. We all know what that means. It's not universal across China, but in some places those things are happening, and it's not a good situation. India is a country that I know less about than somebody else here, but Ben had an interesting story once when he was trying to get into India a few years ago. He was just turned down for his visa request. He accidentally put something on his visa application that indicated that he was going to come in and do Christian work, and they didn't like that, so they denied his visa, although later he was able to get in, and he's been there three or four times by now. North Korea is the most brutal regime on earth. They intentionally hunt down Christians to exterminate them. And I won't mention what they do when they find Christians. It is way too gruesome for public consumption. In fact, it's way too gruesome for private consumption. I wish I did not know. It is the stuff of nightmares. Nicaragua is a country I've been to also many, many times, maybe two dozen. President Daniel Ortega was the leader of the Sandinista revolution in the 80s. If you're of age, you may remember that time. He is a socialist tyrant and a dictator. One of his tactics is simply to buy Christian pastors to publicly support him. I mean, buy him with money. He says, I'll give you this much money, and he's got it all. He's worth, I think, $2 billion, like most dictators are. And he just buys them, and some give into that because the people are so poor. If you don't support my socialist tyranny, I'm going to make it tough for you. If they don't comply or if they dare speak out against him, the first thing he does is turn off the church electricity and water. And we think, well, that's not really persecution. That's true. But remember the climate in the tropics. If you don't have the power to at least run a fan and you don't have water, it's more than an inconvenience. And if they dare march in the street, he sends out the death squads and they shoot them. 3 years ago, just about this time of year, there were people who marched in the streets, not just pastors and Christians, there were others as well, marching against his socialist tyranny. And he sent out the military-trained snipers to find elevated positions to make headshots, to make sure he killed them. And they killed about 600 people in the street. And when some mothers went out and marched against the killing of their young people, he just shot them too. Well, so much for socialism. Buyer beware. Those with ears to hear, let them hear. Now let's change different type of governments a little bit. What about Finland? We think, well, Finland, yeah, that's a pretty reasonable country. Just recently, I read of this only about a week ago, an author was arrested and is on trial for writing that men and women are different. And he used, I don't know if it's a he or she, used the Bible as support. Oh, well, that doesn't fit into the LGBTQ plus agenda very much. So that person is on trial for stating that the Bible says men and women are different. And some people are concerned that depending on how that trial goes, it might set a precedent, not only for Finland, but for elsewhere, about publicly quoting the Bible, making it illegal. Switzerland, now we think the Swiss, these are reasonable, calm people. Indeed they are. The Swiss government recently criminalized what they call homophobia, meaning that speaking about Christian morality on that issue is classified now as a hate crime punishable by law. Canada, parents can now be arrested for discouraging their own kids about transgenderism. Parents can be arrested for discouraging their own kids about transgenderism. Madness. What about the U.S.? Certainly we haven't fallen into that pattern, have we? Well, our government and our society are just following right along, and the primary area of attack is this LGBTQ plus revolution. The plus is on there so more of the alphabet can be added for more assorted perversions. Christian bakers and florists and photographers, in some cases, are deliberately targeted to be sued if they won't perform their skill for a gay marriage, and they, in some cases, lose their business, not to mention the thousands of dollars of legal expenses that they try to defend themselves in court. Some Christian schools are forced to remove policies with critical language about the LGBTQ plus lifestyle. And if current trends continue, I suspect Bible colleges and seminaries will be next, and eventually churches. Well, we know who eventually wins this global spiritual war. Jesus comes back and he wins. And in him, we win too. But in the meantime, the war is real and it's very intense. It is the spiritual Wild West out there in many parts of the world. So, how do American Christians become what I'll call world-class Christians? By that I mean truly missions-minded people. A number of principles that I think will help. One, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It all begins with that, the great commandment. Without passion for God, we won't have passion for missions. In fact, without passion for God, you won't have passion for much of anything, because love of God is the fuel of life. Number two, pray. Include missions on your prayer list, and individual missionaries, and please include us at Teaching Truth International, and include our global partners who are translators and people who organize things for us around the world. Some of them live in dangerous places and face very, very risky situations. Pray for government attitudes. Pray for our organizational skills. You know, it's not so easy to set up from a distance how to get to places and have these big conferences go on, which is why we depend on our partners so much, but it's still very complex. Pray for our travel and our safety and our being in these places. Pray for money for our training center in Tanzania. Pray for our support staff here in the U.S., because they work very hard to make it possible for us to do what we do. So number one, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Number two, pray. Number three, deny yourself. How un-American to suggest such a notion. By the way, that's not my idea. Jesus said that. Do you remember what Joel Osteen, the most famous prosperity preacher, said about that? I'm quoting him now. Quote, if anyone tells you to deny yourself, he's the devil. End quote. So much for the prosperity gospel. Deny yourself. Life is not all about you. That is a lie from our godless culture. Life is all about God and his glory, his word and his work. So place his agenda above your own. Number four, simplify. If we are buried beneath layers of toys and to-do lists, we won't have time for God or missions or anything of value. So rather than accumulate, I like the word decumulate. Reduce the clutter of stuff and the chaos of schedule to discover the freedom of a simple life. It is liberating and refreshing like almost nothing else. Number five, give. We reveal what's important to us by where we put our money. Our heart follows our money. Jesus talked about that in the Sermon on the Mount. If you invest money in a stock, you're going to check how that stock is doing quite regularly, whether it may not be daily, but at least weekly or monthly, you follow where that goes. And the same is true for missions. If you give toward missions, your interest will grow. Number six, stay informed about missions. Read missionary biographies. Some of the best things I've ever read are some of the biographies of the old missionaries that first went to Africa or the Pacific Islands or all over the world. Fantastic reading. And they're true. They're better than a novel because they're true. Read newsletters from missions agencies. Read reports from individual missionaries. A book I recommend is a great place to start. Is written by Ruth Tucker. It is entitled From Jerusalem to Irianjaya. From Jerusalem to Irianjaya. It's about a generation or more old now, but it is a fantastic list of about 200 mini biographies and mission stories all the way back to the early church. It is a great read. Ruth Tucker, From Jerusalem to Irianjaya. Number seven, go on a short-term mission trip. Make it a real one, not a spiritualized vacation. We hear from missionaries on the field and the nationals on the field that some of the missions trips that come from America really don't accomplish much. In fact, I've even heard people say, we just have to babysit them because because they haven't planned, they don't know what they're doing, they just come and have a fun time, they don't know any work, and we lose 10 days of work because we're having to babysit them. Why not just send us the $20,000 it took to send them over here? We've heard that from more than one place. So make sure it's a real one. But if you go on a real missions trip, that can change your life. It will take you out of the comfort zone of the so-called good life of America, which is really a trap to focus your attention away from God. Well, those seven steps will help you become more missions-minded, more of a globally-minded Christian. So let me close with this. The global church is looking to the American church for help in many ways, but primarily in two ways, two factors. One, we know the book. We know the Bible. The American church has the densest concentration of biblical scholars and teachers in the history of the world. And two, the American church has the money to send them throughout the world. The American church in our time has more money than the church in all the places of the world throughout the last 2,000 years put together. The American church is that rich, and it can send the Word of God around the world. And I believe God has deliberately merged those two resources here in the U.S. And I am enormously thankful that God has given me this remarkable privilege of teaching His Word across the world. It has been beyond a dream come true, because growing up right here in Hutch, I never could have dreamed of something so outrageous back in the 50s and 60s. Sometimes people might ask me if I'm afraid to go to some of the places I go. And the answer is no, not really. I mean, first of all, I'm in God's hands. And most of the places I go are reasonably safe, as long as I don't do anything outrageously stupid, as opposed to just typically stupid. But if some of the places aren't completely safe, I'm far more afraid of something else, and that is wasting my life. I do not want to do that. And I urge you the same, do not waste your life. The real spiritual danger, in fact, might be right here in the U.S. The spiritual danger might be right here, where society buries Christians under affluence and apathy. It sort of numbs our spiritual vitality. The U.S. may be the most spiritually dangerous place in the world to live and raise kids. So I urge you to be careful living here. Well, thanks again for your partnership and your prayers. You make it possible for us to do what we do. God is using you not only to help us, but He is extending your reach way beyond the Kansas prairies.